The name of this session is, oh, by the way, I should introduce myself. My name is Lynn Billman, and my pseudo name is Randy Isaac. Lynn apologizes she couldn't be here, and last minute cancellation. So at any rate, our session here is titled Social and Psychological Sciences, Reflections on Identity Formation. We've got a great program for you here. And to lead us off, we've got our first talk with Tony Jelsma, who's from Dort University, on title of his talk is The Use of Puberty Blockers in Childhood Gender Dysphoria. Thank you, Tony.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, this is actually my third talk in 5 years on this subject, and also written a paper and just submitted another paper. And one thing I found out is there's really a need for civility and humility in this area. This is a highly polarized debate, and we as Christians shouldn't make things any worse. We also need to recognize that everyone involved in this field really wants the best for those who are affected by this condition, and because they are really stressed and distressed. So we need to remember, in a sense, we're all on the same side. We also need humility, because the science is really still incomplete and it's rapidly developing. I'm finding a new paper just about every day that I'm reading and learning new things, and that's going to keep going on for some time. Also, this is a very complex subject, and it's really not helpful to make generalizations about things, because then we end up not really understanding the situation. Also, as a biologist, I'll be speaking, and that's really my area of interest, I'll be speaking on the biology in this talk as well. For me, the question really is, what is gender anyway? And so knowing what it is may help us to know what to do about it when it doesn't match with our biological sex. So how does it develop, and what is the relationship between gender and sex? So I'll quickly go over the development of sex. So at 6 weeks of age, the gonads are bipotential. They haven't decided whether they can become testes or ovaries. If the fetus is male, there's a Y chromosome that has an SRY gene that gets turned on at that stage. That stimulates the gonads to develop into testes, which will then start producing testosterone, and then we get the male developmental pathway. And if we don't have an SRY gene, then we get the female developmental pathway. So those are the reproductive organs, but what about the most important reproductive organ, the brain? So as testes develop, the testosterone levels, they rise in the body. And that testosterone will enter the male brain and be involved in masculinizing the male brain. We also need to note that some of that testosterone gets converted to estrogen. So what we actually have is both estrogen and testosterone in the male brain. The blood has plenty of estrogen because it comes from the mother through the placenta. However, that is bound up. And so it's inaccessible. So what we have is male fetal brains have both testosterone and estrogen, and female fetal brains have neither. Okay, so that is kind of the brain sex in a sense, but what about gender itself? And here's where we have a lot of confusion and conflation that we have to be careful about. Gender is really the internal sense of whether you are male or female, or if you identify as non-binary, as neither. It's distinct from, but it's often confused with, gender expression. So how you express what you feel your gender is, or your sexual attraction, whether you're same sex or opposite sex attracted. So if that's what gender is, your internal sense, what is the relationship of that to sex? Now, there are two common ways that are views of gender that I've seen, and I'll give you some quotes that kind of describe them. I'm indebted to Filippo Dovale, who wrote a book, Gender as Love, for a lot of his critique of these two positions, the essentialist position and the social construct position. So here's a quote by Jack Turbin, who's probably the most prominent transgender advocate. And he wrote, "The most basic part of gender identity is what I call our transcendent sense of gender. In a way that goes beyond language, people just feel male or female. It's hard to describe, but it's the foundation of our gender identity. And so that's really, in a sense, that's who you really are. Now, Jack is not a Christian, but here's a quote by a Christian. So Frederick Baumann was a surgeon at the Free University Medical Center. He did a lot of those early sex change operations in the 60s and 70s. And he said, from a Christian point of view, the soul, the psyche, should be considered more important than the body. So if the soul is so disturbed that it makes people feel unhappy, it's allowed to help them in this way. And so from a Christian perspective, he supports that as well. Well, there is an element to this. I have a critique of that, or several critiques of it. One is I see this as a radically dualist type of perspective, separating the body and the mind in a way, and I think our bodies and minds are much more closely integrated. And also, when there's a conflict, it seems to be the body that gets denigrated, or the body needs to change in favor of the mind. Also, from a Christian perspective, this view is susceptible to Gnosticism, which, again, only the spiritual is important and the physical is not. But also from a scientific perspective, one's sense of gender can change. So children with gender dysphoria, it often desists, and I'll talk about that more later. At puberty, some people identify as gender fluid, so if it's an essentialist position, it shouldn't be able to change in that way. And also, even in the lab, you can do these gender swap illusions to change someone's sense of gender, even temporarily. So if gender is not, if the essentialist view is not correct, what about gender being merely a social construct? And this quote is not quite the best one I could find, but anyway, Florence Ashley is a transgender law professor who says that gender self-determination means that individuals have a right to define, express, and embody their gender identity as they see fit. So in other words, it's not essential essence of who you are, but you can decide what you are and then have that gender. So that's really incompatible with Turbin's position. I have a problem with that one as well, partly because I think there is a biological contribution to gender. It's a contribution, it's not completely deterministic, but I think there is a biological component to it that I'll talk about a bit later. And most people cannot change their gender identity. So. I don't see that holding. So if it's neither of those, what is it then? And I see gender as a matter of perception. Now, just earlier I heard a talk about perception as well, and so that found that helpful. But here, apologize for the long quote, but Gregory Burns is a neuroscientist. He says, the question of self-identity, and this is really a perception thing, boils down to one of self-perception, namely how you think about yourself. It used to be you look in the mirror, see your body, you can decide what gender you are, but we now understand that what you do with that information, your own sense of gender identity, whether congruent or not, is a matter of perception, and that is a process that occurs in the brain. So when I say perception, it's not just, oh, I think this is what it is. This whole process of perception is an essential component for physiological functioning. So what do I see gender then really being? I don't see it as an entity. I see it more as a process. So as we develop, a fertilized egg doesn't have a gender, a fetus doesn't have a gender, a newborn baby doesn't have a gender, but as the baby starts to develop and becomes aware of who they are, then they develop that sense of gender. So in that sense, it elaborates from their sex. It's not something that's measurable. There's no objective measure of it, and it is a perception, and as such, it could also be misperceived. Or incorrectly perceived. I see two periods when this gender development and susceptibility to change occurs, prenatal and adolescence. So prenatally, as I mentioned before, the hormonal environment seems to be involved in determining whether you're going to be male or female in the brain. There are a variety of gene variants or gene mutations which are actually involved in responses to those hormonal environment, and they can result in an altered frequency of gender incongruence. And also exposure to endocrine disruptors can also do that as well. So I think the early stuff is really a hormonal, there is a biological basis to that. In the adolescence, we have a tremendous development of the mind-body connection, as anyone who's had teenagers will know. And that's when also the person could be susceptible to a gender incongruence as well, partly also with the social conditioning stuff. I'm not going to talk about that. I'm going to focus more on the prenatal. So we have the two types of gender incongruence, as I mentioned, the early onset, which we've known for some time, exists at a low frequency, primarily in males, and I think it's hormonal and based. And then we also have the adolescent onset, which is a more recent phenomenon, and it's continuing to increase in frequency, and it has more females than males. So I'm just going to focus on the earlier one. So, So what happens in these cases is that the children have this lifelong gender incongruence, or as children, and then when they reach puberty, the various studies that I've seen have indicated that 2/3 to 3/4 of these cases desist, and most of those people are actually same-sex attracted. And so then it goes away with the rush of hormones associated with puberty. But for those in whom it doesn't desist and it persists, it gets much worse. And the problem is, it's really hard to tell who will desist and who will persist. And so the two approaches that have been used is the watchful waiting. In other words, you watch the child go into puberty, keep a close eye on them, and see whether things get better or things get worse. And if they get worse, then we got to do something about it. But now we see more of a pressure for what's called gender-affirming care, which means you block them as soon as they enter puberty with puberty blockers, I'll describe them. And then that gives them some time to decide, are they going to persist or desist? And then we'll see. So how do puberty blockers work? And here's where I need to use my marker a little bit here. So the hypothalamus is up here, and it produces this hormone called gonadotropin-releasing hormone. And what that does is it travels a couple millimeters to the anterior pituitary, where it stimulates the production of two more hormones, the luteinizing hormones and follicle-stimulating hormone. I'll ignore FSH. Luteinizing hormone goes down to the gonads to cause the production of testosterone or estrogen, depending on whether we got testes or ovaries. Okay, so the puberty blockers, they act at that first step, the GnRH step. And so what they'll do then is they'll prevent or block the effect of the GnRH, so then in response, the luteinizing hormone doesn't get produced, and then the other hormones, the sex hormones, don't get produced either. Now, these puberty blockers have been used in other contexts. For example, for precocious puberty, if a child's entering puberty at 7 or 8 years old, it makes sense to use them, and they have been used in that context. Also, there are some breast and prostate cancers that are sensitive to hormones, and these drugs are used as well to slow down the growth of these cancers. But the application of puberty blockers in this context was first done in the Netherlands at the Free University Medical Center, and that's what is known as the Dutch protocol. You may have heard of that. So, do they work? Well, first of all, dysphoria does not go away with the puberty blockers, and as was pointed out, it wasn't expected to, because as a child enters puberty, you're just allowing them to stay prepubescent with the puberty blockers. But what happened then was, then we didn't have the rush of hormones that would allow the brain to be reprogrammed, and so virtually all the patients in that went on to transition, when normally you would expect 2/3 to 3/4 of them to desist. So why is that? Well, that was addressed in the study, and the authors suggested, well, we had a good careful selection of patients that we knew would persist. I don't think that's what's going on. I think what's really going on is that the puberty blockers are blocking the very thing that's going to cause the desistance, which is those sex hormones. Now, does gender-affirming care benefit the patient? And this is a really contentious debate. There are numerous studies, and we're talking over 100, that do show benefits to mental health of these patients. Question is, how strong is the evidence? When you're doing studies of this sort of nature, there are three tiers that you can do. The gold standard is these controlled double-blind studies that you're following with placebos and things like that. If you can't do that, then there are observational studies where you follow people for a period of time after you give them the treatment. And if you can't do that, there are case studies, individual studies. And you can imagine the strength of the evidence diminishes as you go down. Now, the weaknesses of these gender-affirming care studies is, with both puberty blockers and the cross-sex hormones, it's impossible to do the first category. You can't do a double-blind study because the child will know whether they're getting the puberty blockers and the hormones. And actually, when they get the hormones, there's something that Jack Turbin calls a gender euphoria. You feel really good. And so you can't have a control in that situation. So instead, you have observational studies. The challenge with observational studies is that there aren't that many people in a particular area that are taking these drugs. And so the numbers that you get, maybe 50 to 100 is a good size study, so your statistical power is diminished. There are some studies that use your public health records, and where you can get thousands of people, but the problem is the type of data you get from them is much more limited than if you're actually following these people. Incidentally, those public health record studies do not show a benefit or a reduction in suicide and things like that. The other problem is these individuals, they have other comorbidities. There's anxiety, depression, a high proportion of them have autism as well. And so it's not just one thing, the dysphoria, it's other things as well. The other thing is these patients, in addition to getting the drugs, they get treatment, they get counseling and other things like that. So it's not just one thing that's being dealt with. I think the biggest concern for me is there's a lack of a control group. So how do we discount the placebo effect? These children are stressed, they're seeing somebody, they're getting a treatment, it makes them feel good, and of course their mental health is going to be better. The question is, what's going to happen years down the road? Are things going to be better? And right now, there aren't these long-term studies. And even people in the field are saying, we need to know 5 years, 10 years down the road. And many studies haven't even gone that far. And maybe some people are following it now, but not at that stage yet. So these short study durations, they cannot discount the placebo effect. And then lastly, there's a significant loss to follow-up. So lost my train of thought for a minute. So when I look at these studies, a lot of them have people dropping out of the trials, so they couldn't follow them. And you can imagine, if you're not happy with how things are going, then you're just going to drop out of the trial. So then the concern is, the people who are left, is that actually an accurate representation of the original population? So the data is really not saying much one way or another. But there's other things that puberty blockers do. For one thing, these GnRH receptors are not just in the pituitary, but they're also in the brain. The hippocampus, which is involved in memory, the amygdala for emotions, and even for smell. And studies on puberty blockers with precocious puberty, some animal studies, and even one case study I saw with a transgender child, they show effects on cognitive, emotional, and reactivity and anxiety. In the one trans case, the child's IQ dropped 10 points, and that does not recover either. Moreover, the luteinizing hormone receptors, they're also found in the brain and in the hippocampus and in the cortex. And again, the effects of decreased LH are decreased cognition as well. And there's also a concern for loss of bone density. Trans kids, as they enter treatment, they have low bone density in the first place, probably because they're much less physically active. When they get the puberty blockers, that difference between them and the others increases because puberty increases bone density. There's a partial catching up a little bit later, but it never really gets back to it. So bone density is a real challenge and a concern. And of course, there's a loss of fertility as well. So thus, puberty blockers are not simply reversible pause buttons. They have physiological consequences as well. And they also result in virtually everyone transitioning when they wouldn't otherwise. So how do we think of gender incongruence? And here's where things get pretty controversial. Is it a normal variation that we see in the population, or is it a disorder? Now, again, I need to emphasize in how we express our gender, that can be normal variation. And so the idea of having rigid gender roles is really not helpful. But there is normal variation. But I would say if you have a condition that requires medical treatment, which includes loss of fertility, how can you describe it as anything but a disorder? So how do we as Christians look at this? Again, as I said, it's a complicated subject. We need to keep working through the questions. Data has continued to come in all the time, and it's a multifaceted issue. I'm just talking about the biology, but the philosophy, theology, ethics, there's a whole bunch of other areas as well that we need to keep in mind. And as yet, we don't have any clear-cut answers, so we have to be careful how we proceed. And unfortunately, in this fallen world, we just can't escape living in tension, and that's just the way things are. So I hate to leave you hanging like that, but that's it. So I'll take questions.
Thanks. Yeah, my name is Cliff Martin, and you indicated that later onset, the adolescent onset of gender dysphoria, is increasing in occurrence. Do you mean by that that there's data to show that there's more of that today than there might have been 100 years ago? Or
yes.
Are you suggesting, okay, that it's not just being expressed becoming more public or more maybe acceptable and thus encouraging more people
right.
to not dwell in confusion, but to actually
right. Right.
state where they are.
There are a variety of reasons that are put forward for the increased numbers. It could be the greater social acceptance, right, as well, and just greater awareness of the condition as well. I think there's more to it than that. I think our adolescents are far more stressed now than they used to be, and that anxiety and social pressure and things like that could contribute to it as well.
Well, would you talk a little bit about maybe diet or how we process food affecting that? Do you think there's anything that there could be in our environment that is driving it?
I don't know about food or anything like that. You're thinking that it might affect our hormonal environment or something like that? The problem is it's really hard to know because when the child is gender dysphoric, then, well, you got to find out what the mom was eating or whatever. So that's really hard to do. But I think a likely possibility is that it's somehow the hormonal environment got disrupted in some way. But it's really hard to, yeah. I think it just kind of might lean in one direction or another in terms of your perception, which you might be more likely to perceive or get an incongruence between your sex and gender. So.
Tony, could you talk a little bit more about fertility? Because obviously, if you're having operations to become the other gender, your organs are gone.
Yes.
But what if you are only taking the blockers?
Right. There was one study or a preprint I saw that was done in the Mayo Clinic, and this was a male, and they showed the histology of the testes after 2 years of puberty blockers. And the testes were a mess. So there's no sperm-producing cells, which we knew anyway, but even the other cells, the Sertoli cells, if anyone knows, they were also messed up. So that person would have been, I can't see that recovering afterwards. There are some animal studies where they put, I think, rats on puberty blockers, females, and then they took them off, and they were able to reproduce afterward. So that's a possibility. But as I pointed out, if you're on puberty blockers and then you go to cross-sex hormones, very few people go back to that once they're on the puberty blockers.
Perry Marshall, I've read that plastics in food and water affect hormonal development. Do you have any comments about any of that?
In your last talk, I think you said, I don't know, and I think I'm going to do the same thing. It could be. I really don't know.
Yeah, I'm Charles Hunt from UC Davis. I've gotten conflicting reports from different people because, as you said, this is a controversial topic. Are both biological boys and biological girls that take puberty blockers, do they all become sterile as a consequence, or do some, or do is it rare, or is it frequent, or what is the consistency of that? And also, can you comment on the fact that some governments have intervened and said we don't allow this because we think you might be doing permanent damage to somebody that might have different feelings about this later in life.
Right. As to your first question, in males, it seems like it would destroy puberty. In females, maybe not. I'm not sure. Yes, the government situation, it varies. There was the CAS review that came out in the UK, and as a result, in the UK, they are no longer using puberty blockers. And in Sweden and Finland and Denmark, they've cut back a lot. Now, in the US, depending on what color your state is, you're going to have that same sort of situation as well. So this is a highly contentious debate, and it kind of depends on, and this is where politics gets into it, and that's not great either. So that's kind of a messy answer to your question, but yeah.
But they all become sterile.
The boys presumably would. Well, if you're on the puberty blockers, then your dysphoria is not going to go away, and therefore you will transition. And if you will transition, then you will become sterile. No, if you go off the puberty blockers and don't transition, then girls might still be fertile. But that's only a study that's been done in rats.
Just a matter of clarity, this idea of prenatal dysphoria is kind of new to me. So these are kids that something happens prenatally in the womb, and then they're born, and then as early as they can vocalize or describe themselves, they are confused about their gender. Is that right?
Well, I wouldn't even use the word confused. They would insist that they, like, I'm not a boy,
yes.
I am a girl. But
and
yes.
And you mentioned a study where a large number of these prenatal kids desist.
Yes, there's several studies pointing to that. That once they hit puberty, then they get the massive rush of either testosterone or estrogen, and that kind of reprograms the brain, and then the dysphoria or incongruence goes away. In most, but not all.
Yeah. Good. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, let's thank Tony again for an excellent talk. Thank you.